rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
What did they know, and when did they know it? That's the one thing they don't want us talking about. Welcome to our program today. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. The Bushies don't want us talking about what did they know and when did they know it with regard to 9/11. They love it. They love it that we are debating whether or not that little blip of silver in that film that the Pentagon released was a missile or an airplane. They love it that we're debating whether or not there was controlled detonations of the World Trade Buildings 1, 2, and 7. They love it that we are speculating about the kinds of things that they can, which, whether or not they're true, and I'll tell you, I'm agnostic on this. Having spent 17 years working on the Kennedy assassination, I know that there, you know, you can come up with enough selective facts to basically convince anybody of anything. Because I've been there and I've been convinced of at least three different theories with regard to Kennedy, you know, before we really started to do the serious shoe leather research. And it's just, with regard to 9/11, as I said, I'm an agnostic. I do not have a particular theory, which is not to say that I believe the official story. I don't, not for a minute, because the official story is so full of holes and so incomplete. But I have to say, I am convinced that the Bush administration wants nothing more, that there is nothing that they want more than for us to be sitting around discussing things that don't have to do with what I consider to be the fundamental question of 9/11, which is, when did George W. Bush know that the attacks were going to happen? What level of detail did he have about when the attacks were going to happen and how they would happen and where they would happen? Who else in the administration had this level of knowledge? What did they know, and when did they know it? And did these attacks happen because they were allowed to happen? Or let me rephrase that. Were these attacks allowed to happen? Because we know that there were people inside the United States who knew this was coming. You had Colleen Rowley out there jumping up and down saying, hey, we've got some information here, and the FBI going, shut up and keep quiet. So were these attacks allowed to happen because of A, good old garden variety incompetence on the part of our government, which in my mind is, you know, one credible theory. There certainly is enough of it. Or B, and certainly in the Bush administration. I mean, it's like you could ask the same question about New Orleans. Was New Orleans allowed to melt down and be destroyed because of incompetence of the Bush administration or because of malice, because they wanted to turn this into from a Democratic state into a Republican state? I could build a good case for either one of those two. And with regard to 9/11, was it allowed to happen because of incompetence on the part of the Bush administration? Or was it allowed to happen because the Project for New American Century, signed off on by Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Richard Pearl, Doug Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, Jeb Bush, back in 1998 when he was being groomed to be president. They just hadn't reckoned on the power of Karl Rove wanting his guy to be the guy. Because Jeb Bush was the guy, he was the Bush who was supposed to be the next president, you know. They'd all, in the party, they'd all largely written off George. He was a dry drunk. He was AWOL when he was in the National Guard. He had that cocaine arrest back when he was a youngin'. He had these drunk driving arrests. I mean, you know, and he's never done anything successfully. Everything he's touched has fallen apart. The one exception being the baseball team, and there it was successful because they kept him out of the way. Let him walk away with millions of dollars, but they kept him out of the way. So he was not the guy. He was not the Bush that the Republicans were grooming and the neocons were grooming to be the next president. It was Jeb. And Jeb signed off on the Project for a New American Century. You can still find it on their website, newamericancentury.org, in 1998. And they came right out and said, you know, the invasion of Iraq is a necessary thing. I'm paraphrasing. But essentially, they said it's important to the American national security to nail down our oil supply, to have a strong international presence, a geopolitical strategic position, to protect our ally Israel, to protect our interests in the region. It is important that we have a large footprint there. And Saudi Arabia ain't it. They're all upset with us for the few thousand soldiers that we had there, that we put there in 1991 for the very first time. In fact, this guy Osama bin Laden's yelling that he's going to strike us in the United States if we don't get the soldiers out of there, because it's holy ground and they're defiling it. So what did Bush know? When did he know it? What did the Bush administration know? When did they know it? Dick Cheney, you'll recall, when the Bushes came into power, Dick Cheney was given two jobs: to put together an energy policy for the United States, which he was working on, man, in March and April of 2001, long before 9/11. He was meeting with the executives of the oil company. He went to the Supreme Court to keep the names of these guys secret. But Judicial Watch was able, with a lawsuit, to at least pry out some of the paperwork from those meetings. And sure enough, there's a map of the country of Iraq with its oil fields carved up and identified. You can see all this over at JudicialWatch.org's website. And its oil fields carved up and identified, and a list of countries and companies in those countries that might want to buy that oil. This is what Cheney was doing before 9/11. Planning on how they're going to sell the oil in Iraq after Iraq was conquered, with the executives of the big oil industry in the United States. How can we jack up the profits for the oil industry in the United States? Well, we'll give them $12 billion in tax benefits and bonuses and rebate. We'll bring the nuclear guys in on this thing. Wind power and solar. What are they, hippies? Nah. So he was given responsibility for the energy policy, and he was given responsibility for counterterrorism. Dick Cheney. And his task force on counterterrorism, his anti-Osama bin Laden task force, never met before September of 2001. Never met. Now, was that intentional or incompetence? Judy Miller is what brings all this up for me. The reason I'm going off on this thing is because Judy Miller, there's an interview today. This is an exclusive to Alternet. You can find it over at alternet.org. Rory O'Connor and William Scott Malone wrote this piece. And they got this exclusive interview with Judith Miller and her editor at the Times, Stephen Engelberg. And they note that they both Judy Miller and Scott Engelberg remembered and regretted the story they didn't do. The story they didn't do? This is in 9/11. Turns out in July of 2001, July, August, September, this is 3 months before 9/11. In July of 2001, Judy Miller's getting information that something's coming. In fact, what she's being told is that on July 4th, there's a good chance that something's coming, that the U.S. is going to get hit. She said in this interview, she said, "I had begun to hear rumors about intensified intercepts and tapping of telephones, but that was just the vaguest kind of rumors in the street, indicators. I remember the weekend before July 4th, 2001 in particular, because for some reason the people who were worried about Al-Qaeda believed that that was the weekend that there was going to be an attack on the United States or on a major American target somewhere. It was going to be large, well-coordinated attack. Because of the July 4th holiday, this was the ideal opportunistic target and date for Al-Qaeda." Now, if Judy Miller knew that in July of 2001, are you trying to tell me that George Bush didn't know that? And if he did know that, why didn't he do a damn thing about it? Why didn't they start putting sky marshals on airplanes? Why didn't they harden the cockpit doors? Why didn't they raise security levels at the airports? Aside from the fact that they had privatized all that and they had people running the security at the airports who were making a little less than managers of Burger King. But why didn't they do any of this stuff? Why didn't they go to the American people and say, you know, do you know anything about that? We think that there's these guys from Al-Qaeda. You know, do you have any suspicious guys? You know, why didn't they do any of that? Could it be because 9/11 was actually the thing that they really needed? That it was actually very useful for them? Judy Miller goes on to say, "My sources also told me at the time that there had been a lot of chatter overheard. I don't know specifically what that meant, but a lot of talk about an impending attack at one time or another. And the intelligence community seemed to believe that at least part of the attack was going to come on July 4th. So I remember for a lot of my sources, this was going to be a lost weekend. Everyone was going to be working. Nobody was going to be taking time off. She's talking about her sources inside the counterterrorism community. She refers to it as the CT people and the intelligence community. And she says, that's bad news for me because it meant I was going to have to be on standby. I'd be working too. And then she talks about how on 9/11, she's in New York, and when the second plane hit the second tower, she goes, oh, my God, this is it. This is what they told us about back in July. Now, if they told her about it, why didn't they tell George Bush about it? Or if they did, why didn't he do anything about it? Your thoughts, 866-440-8466, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Why me, George? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the plagues that you've sown? Tell me, George.
In my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in. To kind of catapult the propaganda.
Lord help me, Jesus. We didn't vote for him, but we can't ignore him, I fear. He's using your name to advance his own game. Now we're in doo-doo, way up to here.
And welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. What did George Bush know prior to the attacks? What did Dick Cheney know prior to the attack? What did Condoleezza Rice? It was her job to know this stuff. She was the National Security Advisor. Sandy Berger told me personally that when he met with Condi Rice and handed off to her from his job to her job, that he said to her, your number one priority is going to have to be Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Because these guys are coming after us. And we have tried to stop them. And we have tried to kill this guy. And we were not successful. But we have tried. And you need to finish that effort. And then we learned from Paul O'Neill, no, the first thing they did was get together in the White House and talk about, how do we get into Iraq? Well, you go back and you read the document of the Project for a New American Century, and Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Jeb Bush said the way you get into Iraq is you have a Pearl Harbor-like event. We sure did. 1-866-440-8466. I think it's time for us to just, you know, spend an hour thrashing this out, or maybe two or three. I don't know. We'll see how the show goes. There's a lot of other news here I want to bring you up today on what's going on in Iraq, and the Competitive Enterprise Institute is fighting back now. They've got a couple of ads out saying carbon dioxide is good for you. They're going to be running them in media markets all around the country. We'll be talking about that. Coming up also in the program at the beginning of the next hour, Alvin Toffler, at the top of the next hour, is going to be with us. He's the author of a new book. You all remember Alvin Toffler. This guy's been around for forever and just writing some brilliant stuff. And he's got a new book, Revolutionary Wealth, How It Will Be Created and How It Will Change Our Lives. And in our third hour, we're going to be speaking with the executive director for Voters Unite, votersunite.org, about what's going wrong with voting systems. What did we learn from the primaries that are happening around the country here? We had, just in one city in Pennsylvania, for example, 100 machines cracking up, melting down, failing. So John Gideon is going to be with us, the executive director for Voters Unite. Tony in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Tony. What's up?
Love the show. Hey, Loose Change. There's a documentary on Google Videos called Loose Change, Second Edition. Have you seen it?
I've seen it. I have at least a half a dozen DVDs and VHS copies that various people have sent me over the months. Plus, you know, you can see it on the web. Yeah, I've seen it twice.
Yeah. I want to urge, like, everybody that's listening to this show to watch this. I mean, I saw it, and I couldn't sleep for 2 days after watching this video.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's one of the more well put together of the conspiracy theory, and I don't say that by way of, you know, mocking them, but it's one of the better conspiracy theory pieces that are put together out there. I acknowledge it.
I just think that everyone should watch this. I mean, it totally opened my eyes, and you know, I had my dad watch it, and he went from, you know, believe in everything and not, you know, we're not the type that believes in conspiracy theories, but, you know, we both talked about it, and now I think, you know, we think that they knew something. You know, maybe not everything in the movie is true, but there's something else there that we're not being told.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, Tony, the thing to keep in mind is there's probably a million details or facts around 9/11 that could be pulled out and put front and center. And in any 1 hour, you're going to be able to pull out 15, 20, 30 of them. And so, you know, I'm certain that if somebody else wanted to make a loose change that proves that Bush knew nothing about it, that the intelligence knew nothing about it, the official story is the official story and everything is just fine, they could probably do that just as well and be equally convincing. It's so, you know, I think that the challenge for all of us right now, and it's interesting at the Democracy for Oregon Summit this weekend, they're going to actually have a workshop on this, is to keep an open mind and not keep an open mind that there wasn't a conspiracy. Keep an open mind to everything and beware of really wild theories. And I'm not putting loose change in that category, frankly, but really wild theories that are being sold just in the attempt to make us all consider, you know, seem crazy. After the Kennedy assassination, I say this from having researched that thing for 17 years and finally written a 2,000-page book on it, or a 900-page book on it with 2,400 footnotes in it, or helped write it. Lamar and I wrote it together. I tell you that in the early days after the Kennedy administration, when Jim Garrison went after Clay Shaw and there was this whole thing and, oh, we've got it and we figured out who it is and it's this businessman in New Orleans and blah, 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 and the whole country was on it and it was, you know, Time Magazine, Life Magazine, New York Times and everything. And then it turns out there was no there. And after that, it was impossible for anybody to say that they were investigating the Kennedy assassination without everybody around them rolling their eyes and going, oh, no, a nutcase. And I think it's really important that we maintain essentially an open stance and say, we don't know. We don't know. There's a lot of theories out there, and some of them, you know, some of them make a lot of sense, but we don't know. And we need an investigation to find out. We'll be back with more of your calls. I see that phones are totally slammed here right after this, 27 minutes after the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I see people turn their heads and quickly look away. Like a newborn baby, it just happens every day.
I look inside myself and see my heart is glad. I see my red door, I must have it into glass.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Why is the question not being asked front and center as the primary question? What did Bush know and when did he know it? Yeah, whether or not Building 1 and 2 were blown up with explosives or Building 7 was blown up with explosives, I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, it may entirely be the case. It may not be the case. I don't know. I haven't researched that. And to the best of my knowledge, you know, no really good, official, competent investigation was, nor will one be possible now because the debris has all been hauled away, right? The evidence has been destroyed by the Bush administration. But the bigger question in my mind is why? Who knew what inside the Bush administration and when did they know it? And why do they want us talking about missiles and pilots and explosives and all these other things instead of talking about who in the Bush administration allowed this to happen, or perhaps even encouraged this to happen by their foreign policies, or even at the level of on the ground? Bob in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, I agree with you. These guys get, you know, not even a slap on the wrist. I mean, how far?
George Tenet gets the Medal of Freedom.
How far can, you know, stupidity, you know, go without being, you know, being answered to? But you made a comment earlier about when George Bush owned the Texas Rangers, and it sounded almost as if you were giving him a free pass about that. If you remember, Last year, the United States Senate wasted how much time with steroid hearings and all kinds of garbage when they could have been doing something else, you know, to better serve the people. Now, you know what? When George Bush was co-owner of that baseball team, there were four guys, two of which, Jose Canseco, admitted steroid user, Rafael Palmeiro, tested positive, and two others implicated in the whole thing. So it's just par for the course with this guy.
No, so he wasn't even,
how much did he know then?
He wasn't even successful as a junior partner in a baseball team.
He couldn't even do that.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
never had to accept responsibility for any actions throughout his, you know, throughout you
his
know,
entire
any
life.
Business endeavors.
Yeah.
Because
and,
his last name is Bush.
Yeah, that's right. And I would say in school as well, and in the and in certainly in the Army National Guard or the Air National Guard. Yeah, absolutely. Bob, thanks for the call. Good point. And you know, thanks for catching that. Joe in Provo, Utah. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Good. What's up?
Well, two things. One, doesn't matter whether it's 911, Iraq, all of these issues boil down to one thing, and it's all about having a forensic investigation in 911 or having the hearings and so forth. So it really boils down to, you know, we all can stir the pot and have all kinds of conversations about who, what, when, conspiracies, or whatever. The bottom line is until we get a Congress and a Senate that does its job, which is to have the oversight on this, and we won't get that until we get the public in general educated to the fact that the one defining thing that this that represents or defines us as Americans is the Constitution, which is the rule of law. And until we, the people, become a nation that is willing to abide by the rule of law and recognize that 19 guys or whatever it was that happened on 911 is a crime, it's not an act of war.
Yes.
And that should be dealt with accordingly. So that's really the solution, is we've got to get candidates in that are willing to abide by the rule of law, and we've got to get the public educated to the fact that the Constitution, read it, understand it, and apply it to your life and to the people that you want representing you. That's going to solve that.
And get a Congress that actually will oversee some sort of an investigation of some of this stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can look at things like, I've got a copy of a video with the CNN reporter standing there in front of the Pentagon 25 minutes after the whatever hit it, and he's standing there going, well, we have an 18-foot hole back here, but no debris.
Mm-hmm.
So, excuse me, why? I mean, do you have a copy of that?
No, but I've seen it on the web. I've also seen, there's also a website I was looking at last night that shows pictures of actual airplane debris, but they're claiming that the motor size, the engine size, is the wrong size for 757 and more appropriate to a missile. And so that's the missile theory. And so there's sites that say there's no debris, then there's sites that say there was debris, then there's sites that say that it's the wrong size debris, and then there's sites that say, well, the Pentagon, you know, hustled all the debris off, and we'll never know because they covered up the debris. So who knows? I don't know.
I mean, the bottom line is when he's saying there's no debris, he's expecting a 747 debris.
Yeah.
You know, so if there was some, I mean, there was some stuff around there, but the bottom line, I mean, a 747, you're going to have two engines sitting outside with holes in the walls.
757.
Yeah. 757, you know, so anyway.
Yeah.
Good job, Tom.
Thanks a lot,
Joe. You're doing a great job.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Mike in Seattle. By the way, in the chat room, somebody says, hey, wait a minute. Don't be an agnostic. Someday we will know the truth. And that's why I use the word agnostic about this rather than atheist. Atheists say, hey, I know the truth, and it's that there's nothing out there, right? An agnostic says, I don't have any idea what the truth is. And so that's why I say I'm an agnostic on this issue. I don't have any idea. I know that there's a lot that we don't know. That's what I know. Mike in Seattle. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how are you this morning?
I'm great. What's up?
You know, at first when this all happened, I was buying the line that was being, you know, fed us by the government, Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda's responsible. But the more I hear and the more I think about it, the more I look at it, it is absolutely clear that the Bush administration was involved in 911 by their inaction. They removed Richard Clark from you know, as terrorism's are, from a cabinet-level position. If you remember way back in, I think it was February when they first took office, Rumsfeld was saying that he was going to make sure President Bush vetoed the first defense budget, or rejected the first defense budget that was going to take money away from, you know, Star Wars, their version of Star Wars, and put it towards terrorism. He said he was going to make sure that budget was rejected. All of the presidential daily briefings talking about it,
56 different presidential daily briefings. Some talked about buildings, high-profile buildings. Some talked about attacks in Washington and New York. There's the famous one, the August 6th one, when Bush was on vacation that said Bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. And Bush, what does he do? He goes on the longest vacation in the history of the American presidency. And when the strike hasn't happened, he still refuses to go back to Washington, D.C. He's still afraid to go back there. He goes to Florida.
Absolutely. And it wasn't an intelligence failure. See, they've been saying it's been an intelligence failure, but the FBI, the CIA, all of our intelligence and law enforcement, national law enforcement services did have information, and it was a failure of leadership.
Yeah, was it a failure? Look at who got what they wanted out of this thing. Osama bin Laden got what he wanted out of this thing. Judy Miller talks about this in her piece over in Alternate today, which is what got me on this whole thing. She talks about how Osama bin Laden, when he hit the USS Cole, was very unhappy that we didn't overreact. He wanted the U.S. government to so overreact that he would become the world's most famous terrorist. And we didn't. We didn't give him what he wanted. Instead, Bill Clinton simply tried to assassinate him with a cruise missile. And it really upset him. And so he decided that he's going to do something even more spectacular, so he will get what he wants. He will get a government hyper-reaction. And Judy Miller knew about this in July of 2001. Now, she knew about it. How did George Bush not know about it? So you have to ask yourself, who got what they wanted? The two people who got what they wanted, George Bush and the PNAC guys, they got what they wanted in that they got their Pearl Harbor, and Osama bin Laden got what he wanted. The people who didn't get what they wanted, the rest of the world. Jeff in Nashville, and thanks for the call, Tony. Jeff in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. You got to remember one thing. George Bush traded away Sammy Sosa. So I mean, that just talks about what a great owner he was.
Yeah.
And there down here, it is, I moved from Chicago 10 months ago. This is very Republican territory, but I saw a great bumper sticker the other day that said, support our troops, get rid of Bush.
Yeah, yeah.
But going back to the war, I think that one of the reasons the war started, and I agree totally with what everything was said today, was the fact that after they came out of the disputed 2000 election, which Bush lost but won, that they needed to start a war because Americans do not change presidents during a war.
Right, and Bush knew, by the way, let me just interrupt you here for a second, Jeff. Bush knew, and everybody in his administration knew, that the Washington Post, the USA Today, and Time Magazine were counting all the ballots from Florida. And that when they counted them all, you know, I mean, they argued before the Supreme Court that if all the ballots from the entire state were counted, it would cause, I'm quoting from Bush v. Gore, from their lawsuit against Al Gore, it would cause irreparable harm to George W. Bush, end quote, if all the ballots were counted. The irreparable harm, obviously, would be that Gore would have been declared the winner. And that's what happened when they counted all the ballots in the state of Florida. They discovered Gore actually won. So that was ongoing, and they had to divert our attention away from that.
Well, and again, it goes back to the fact, during a war, Americans have never changed presidents. And that was one of the reasons, knowing all the things that happened in 2000, I think maybe even knowing how inept they really are, they needed this to help support and almost ensure the re-election. And the re-election was, again, the closest re-election we had of a sitting president in over, 125 years, I believe.
Yeah, although I would say I think Harry Truman was president during the Korean War, and that's what caused him to lose his reelection bid to Dwight Eisenhower. But because Eisenhower was campaigning on a vote for Eisenhower, vote for peace platform. But nonetheless, your point is well taken, and I appreciate it. Thank you for making it, Jeff. Thanks a lot for the call, Danny in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Danny, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Great show, by the way.
Thank you.
I really have a problem with what's going on out here as far as people talking about a conspiracy. I don't think there was a conspiracy on 9/11 per se, but I do think that the Bush administration was complicit in the idea that they got what they wanted. This has all been, this entire presidency has been a money grab. It's been an opportunity for them to assume more power, which of course feeds their greed. And I think that they did know that there was something that was going to happen. I don't think they thought it would be to the magnitude of what it was, but I think they were willing to give up a few hundred Americans in order to get their attack on Iran, which, again, was for money.
Yeah, to the extent that I will endorse a conspiracy theory, Danny, I agree with you.
Thank you.
Frankly, I don't think it was for money. I think it was for power, and money is one manifestation of power, but we're close enough. But I think, you know, it's so clear that they knew this thing was coming. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I see the stars and stripes outside the courthouse door. And I wonder every night who it stands for anymore. They say that it's gonna be cheaper to make them in China. They'll stitch them and ship them back here in some big ocean liner. They say that it's gonna be cheaper to make them in China.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our toll-free number all across the United States. Also, you can drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. Just click the live chat link. And also for our serious listeners who talked about, you know, how can we hear more of the program, you might want to try calling the folks at Air America Radio who are syndicating the program rather than the folks at Sirius. Mike in Fort Myers, Florida. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom. I called because prior to 9/11, I had read an article. I can't remember if it's in a newspaper or a magazine about Halliburton attempting to build a pipeline across Afghanistan, and the Taliban refused to let them cross southern Afghanistan.
Yeah, they were going to do it with, I believe it was Amoco, wasn't it? And Hamid Karzai, who's now the president of Afghanistan, was a consultant to that oil company. And the offer that was made was, we will offer you a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs, your choice.
Correct. And it just seems to me that the Taliban was tied in with Osama bin Laden. I don't believe in coincidence.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. There you go.
Maybe somebody should look into that a little bit further.
Yep. Good point, Mike. Thanks a lot for the call. There's a lot that we need to be looking into, I'm telling you. Alan in Sicklerville, New Jersey. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Tom. Tom, I think you've got it right on the nose. I think the best answer is the simplest answer. And you put it all, the PNAC website and all the players in this thing, put it all in perspective when you consider how things would have been different had the rightfully elected president, Al Gore, been in charge.
Right.
Number one, Richard C. Clarke still would have been the terrorist czar, and there was nobody more concerned about Al-Qaeda than him.
Yep.
Presumably the National Security Advisor would have been either Sandy Berger or someone of his ilk. George Tenet probably still would have been there, but Louis Free, a known Clinton Gore hater, would have been gone, and Ms. Crowley would have been listened to.
Yep.
And there would not have been 90-plus PDBs totally ignored.
That's right. And if, in the face of all of that, these guys were successful in getting through and whacking us as they did, Gore, President Gore, would have used the good will of the world that we actually got as a bonus of being hit on 9/11 to encourage police agencies around the world to bring in Osama bin Laden, and he'd be sitting in a jail someplace right now.
Absolutely. And look at what they did. As soon as this happened, the first thing they did was they tried to pressure Richard Clarke into suggesting that this was Saddam Hussein.
That's right. I mean, it's crazy beyond imagination.
Yep, it's obvious to the casual observer that they had an agenda. I don't know that they knew when, but I believe sincerely they knew what, and they were hoping and praying that it would happen.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you at all, Alan. It's you just look at who benefited. I mean, that's, you know, it's like the police when they're looking into a murder or something like that. You know, who had something to gain from this? Who had motive, means, and opportunity? And who benefited from 9/11? George W. Bush has been the major beneficiary of 9/11, and the secondary major beneficiary has been Osama bin Laden, who, by the way, is still at large. And might there be something to do with that? John in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Hey, John.
Hi, how you doing there, Tom? God bless you and that double-edged sword you wield.
Well, thank you.
I would like to share a warm and fuzzy. I have a littler sword, but it's been my double, mixed blessing to have these interests, too. With these conspiracies, they're, like you, I keep an open stance. You know, it's interesting. Let's keep it in mind. By all means, makes the best plans. But, you know, when it comes to dwelling on it, maybe it is something not to fear. You know, it's like cockroaches, you know. Whatever these powerful groups or powers are and stuff, you know, it seems to me their power is being invisible and secret. And all you got to do is put a light on it and watch them scatter like cockroaches, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the thing. The Bush administration has done everything they can to keep there from being any light on this, from shipping the debris of 9/11 off to China as scrap metal to be, you know, turned back into things to be shipped back here as toys and products, you've been hearing the whole litany here.
I need not recite it all over again.
Yeah, John, thanks for the call. Good point and well made. Travis in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Travis.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. We have about 45 seconds. What's up?
All right, I'd just like to say it's the globalists that are doing it. It has nothing to do with Bush.
Bush is part of that?
No, if you look into our currency, the Federal Reserve is neither federal or holds any reserves. It's owned by a bunch of European bankers, and they're the ones that are in charge of everything. The borrower is servant to the lender, and we are definitely the borrower.
But what does that have to do with 9/11?
They are the ones that orchestrate the presidency. They are the ones that orchestrate everything. They want to scare you into submission so you'll give up your liberties.
Yeah, well,
if everybody will look on prisonplanet.com, they'll find out a lot of truth about what's happening.
No, I've read the what you call it from Jekyll Island, and you know it's the history of the Fed and all that. And you know, I'm with you. You know, it's not a reserve bank. It doesn't have any reserves. Yeah, but you know what that I don't draw the connection between that and 9/11. Maybe it's there again. Like I said, I'm agnostic on it. I don't know. Give me some evidence, I'll consider it. Give me a lot of evidence, and, you know, maybe I'll write a book about it. But right now, I just don't know. And I think that, but what I do know is that the Bushies are very happy that we're talking about airplanes and missiles and explosives and not talking about who knew about this, when did they know about it, and why did they allow this to happen. That's what they don't want us talking about. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, streaming around the planet at radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, and, of course, from the website of our syndicator, airamericaradio.com. Welcome back to our program. Michael Hayden, General Michael Hayden, by the way, is testifying before Congress as we speak. Just a short clip here. Doug Feith, the Office of Special Plans, the little secret intelligence agency inside the Pentagon that Don Rumsfeld last week said he didn't have, but, you know, everybody pretty much knows he has. They asked Hayden what he thought of it.
Were you comfortable with Mr. Feith's office approach to intelligence analysis?
No, sir, I wasn't. I wasn't aware of a lot of the activity going on, you know, when it was contemporaneous with running up to the war. I wasn't comfortable.
So, interesting. Michael Hayden tap dancing around, but, you know, the guy is the architect of the NSA spying program. He broke the law, so, of course, it's the Bush administration. They want to promote him. We'll get back to that. We'll get back to the discussion that we were having about what Judith Miller says she knows about 9/11 and a whole lot of other issues in a few minutes. First, I wanted to bring on Alvin Toffler. He has a new book out, Revolutionary Wealth. You'll recall his seminal bestseller, Future Shock, and the number of books that he and his wife Heidi have written since then. Some really, truly frame-changing, world-changing, perspective-changing writing has come out of Alvin Toffler over the years, and I'm pleased to have him with us on the program here today. Alvin Toffler, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Revolutionary Wealth, you say, is about how tomorrow's wealth will be created and who will get it and how. How will tomorrow's wealth be created? Who's going to get it and how?
Okay. We're not going to get it the old way.
The old way was to build an industrial society with smokestacks pumping black fumes into the sky, assembly lines down below, turning out mass-produced products, everybody getting up at the same time, going to work at the same, commuting at the same time, going to work at the same time, essentially becoming kind of appendages of a gigantic industrial machine. And I think that era is over, and that we are, and by now I think most people understand that we're moving away from that kind of a mass production society to one which creates more value, more return based on knowledge rather than muscle power.
Now, by we, I assume you're talking about the United States.
I'm talking
China
about the United States.
Is industrializing very quickly.
Well, yes, but you know, the Chinese now understand this game, and so they're doing something that's quite remarkable. You know, for the last half century, the poorer countries of the world have been told that in order to get richer, you have to do what the West did. You have to industrialize. You have to go through the Industrial Revolution, and only then can you think beyond that. But the Chinese are saying, I'm not having that story anymore. The Chinese are saying, yeah, I'll take as much low-tech, as many low-tech jobs as I can away from you and put them into cheap labor factories and build the industrial part of our economy. But we're not waiting to become a fully industrialized economy before we're going after the high-tech stuff, what we in other books have called the third wave stuff, and that we are going to be a leading technology at the leading edge of technology. And so they are racing ahead on what we call a twin-track policy, different from the development strategies that the economists have been preaching for 50 years.
So now, I understand we're in a position now in the United States where we can't build an aircraft carrier without chips from China. We can't build a cruise missile without parts from China. It seems to me like strategically, that's not a wise thing, and it might be a reflection of their following these two tracks and our following only one.
Well,
we're
struggling to understand where we're going. It is really complicated, and in Revolutionary Wealth, we try to simplify it and make it clear that we're not just going through an economic change here. You know, if it were just technology, we're great at technology. We can come up with new technological ideas every week, you know, every minute, if we had to. That's the easy part of change. But the part that's harder and that we devote a lot of space to in Revolutionary Wealth are the social, political, and even cultural implications of all of that. And that we cannot change just the technology without expecting to see major changes taking place alongside that in everything from the attitudes toward gender, changes in race relations, changes in education, which we're not getting, unfortunately, changes in every aspect of the society. And we are heading for a gigantic implosion. By the way, the book is optimistic on the whole, but only if we tackle the problems that face us. And one of them, we're facing an implosion of our major institutions in this country. Because Katrina is the symbol of what's going to happen in field after field. Because we talk about an energy crisis, a pension crisis, a transportation crisis, this crisis, that crisis. Nobody seems to have figured out that maybe they're all one crisis that's systemic throughout the system. And that's the case. And the reason it is one big crisis is that all of these are gigantic industrial age bureaucracies. And that's what we still think can work and can't. When we have a terrorism problem, we create a Department of Homeland Security. What do? We take 14 or 15 little bureaucracies and we make them into one gigantic bureaucracy. Bureaucracy is what's holding us back from the future. And that means we're going to have to radically redesign, reorganize every government agency, every big company, and so on. And we don't know quite how to do that. We're going to have to experiment with new forms of organization, new forms of employment, et cetera, et cetera.
We're talking with Alvin Toffler, alvintoffler.net, his website, Alvin, T-O-F-F-L-E-R. Most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with it. His books, The Third Wave, Power Shifts, Culture Consumers, War and Anti-War, Creating a New Civilization, and his new book, Revolutionary Wealth, How It'll Be Created and How It'll Change Our Lives. Alvin Toffler, you talk about how the enemy of change is consolidation, is giant bureaucracies. Last night I was reading the letters of Teddy Roosevelt, And he was saying the same thing. He was talking about how the consolidation in government and the consolidation in at the state level, at the federal level, and the consolidation in business was something that would prevent growth and would ultimately end up destroying communities and destroying this country.
Well, I wouldn't quite put it that way. Although Teddy Roosevelt is nobody to argue with. Come after you with a stick.
Yeah,
a big stick.
Yeah, for sure. But he did. Yeah. He went after the trusts, and he busted up a lot of them. And you know, I mean, the guy was...
Yeah, but that's the issue of, you know, concentration of economic power. That's right. Part of this. But even without that, even if the economic power were better distributed in society, nevertheless, the Katrina disaster was done by well-meaning people.
Yeah. Well, presumably,
people,
yeah.
They may have been incompetent. They were
very competent a year earlier with Hurricane Charley in Florida. They were the FEMA was distributing checks a week after the hurricane passed to people who were even as much as 200 miles away from the path of the hurricane. They were there with hundreds of thousands of pounds of food. They were there with trucks. They were the buses that Michael Chertoff had promised to Ray Nagin would come so he shouldn't use his own school buses. And all of that got withheld with regard to Katrina, which is causing a lot of people in New Orleans to think that there's more to it than just incompetence.
Well, I'm not one for conspiracy theories. Mostly when things get things are, you know, as disastrous and screwed up as they were in New Orleans, stupidity and conspiracy always vote for stupidity.
Yeah.
But it's not that these people are evil or stupid. It's that the system that they work within prevents them from doing intelligent things. The system was designed for an economy based on millions of people getting up in the morning at the same time, commuting to work at the same time, working on an assembly line as an appendage, a part of the assembly line, and then going home at the same time, turning out mass production rather than diverse and customized production, etc., etc., etc. There are just incredible differences between the requirements of an industrial smokestack muscle based society and economy and what we are living with now. Our economy is not based on muscle power. It's based on brain power. And just to give you one incredible example of the difference, you know, in the traditional industrial smokestack assembly line economy, the resources get used up. And the perfect example is oil. You use it.
And it's gone.
It depletes. It gets used up. But knowledge never gets used up. In fact, you can use knowledge, and everybody can use the same bit of it. Everybody, the arithmetic doesn't get used up.
Right. We're still using Aristotle's knowledge.
And so what you have is knowledge is now become the central resource of the economy, and we don't really know how to deal with it because it's so different from all the other resources that we've dealt with before. The economists have a jargon. They refer to rival and non-rival activities. Rival means if I use it, you can't use it at the same time.
Right.
Non-rival is knowledge. I can use it, you can use it. The more people who use it, the more we'll create. Just stands economics as we've known it.
And people can learn all about this by reading Revolutionary Wealth by Alvin Toffler. You can read more about it on the web at alvintoffler.net. Alvin, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Enjoy the book. Bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Have you forgot?
6 months after he said Osama bin Laden must be caught dead or alive, this president was asked, where's Osama bin Laden? He said, I don't know. I don't really think about him very much. I'm not that concerned.
Mr. President.
I think I ever said I'm not worried about Osama bin Laden. It's kind of one of those exaggerations.
And, you know, again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
You know, they don't want to forget the feeling of horror, but they want to forget that the...
The U.S. has dropped the ball. Bin Laden is still a free man.
And you say we shouldn't worry about Bin Laden.
Well,
think that it's much broader than any one person. Now, this is a war on terrorism. It's broader than any one person. It's a struggle of ideologies.
It's like saying somebody got murdered and the police can't catch him. And when you ask the police, hey, well, how come you haven't caught the murderer? They say, well, it's not about that murder. It's about the war on crime.
The
and
audio tape from Osama bin Laden also makes an offer of a truce with the U.S.
1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
Hi, boy, I'm up on the hill, and there's been some fireworks.
Is this regarding Michael Hayden?
Well, Michael Hayden, there's a little bit of fireworks with there, but there was even a bigger deal on the gay marriage amendment.
So, interesting.
Basically, Senator Spector, who is opposed, apparently, to the constitutional amendment, still believes it should have a vote on the floor, which it actually did 3 years ago. Actually 2 years ago, sorry. He held it in what's called the president's room, right off the floor, because there isn't any electronic media allowed in there. And therefore, people couldn't see the vote. And right before the vote this morning, Senator Feingold said that he was opposed to the amendment. He said he was offender of the Constitution. Then Arlen Specter, who's a moderate, you know, fairly moderate, but can be very nasty at times, said, I don't need to be lectured by you. You are no more a protector of the Constitution than I. And then he said, if you want to leave, good riddance. And then Feingold said, I've enjoyed your lecture too, Mr. Chairman. See ya.
Wow.
It's getting nasty up here.
Yeah, so, well, getting. But, yeah, apparently today it's
and then they pass the constitutional amendment along party lines 10-8.
This is out of the committee.
To get it on the floor. So we're going to have another vote on that.
So, well, you know, it's an election year. The Republicans have to trot out, you know, their whipping boy du jour. And where gays seemed to work last time in the last election to get the base out to into the ballot box. You know, they run all these negative ads which drive down voter participation, and then they throw in, you know, a constitutional amendment or a ballot measure or something like that that will get their base in to vote, and then they'll while they're there, they'll say, well, what the heck, I'll vote for those Republicans anyway. People who otherwise wouldn't have because of all the negative advertising. And it's just, you know, if it's not burning flags, it's let's beat up the gays. It's so tragic that the American people don't see through this institutionalized bigotry that these guys are using to try and sell themselves to our country.
It's amazing. Then, of course, the hearings today. And of all the things, and I'm sure the press won't pick it up, of all the things that came out today, well, there were two things that really flipped me out. One is that Hayden says, he talks about the other agencies. He says, other folks are playing this game. And the DOD, Department of Defense, and others are also bulking up. Meaning that he's going to expand the CIA, because he actually said that at a later time. But he refers to this, other folks are playing this game. I thought, well, you're the Senate hearing. What are you talking about, playing this game? Then he was asked by Senator Feinstein, it was asked about, well, didn't he get an opinion as to whether this was legal. Well, yeah, he got an opinion. His legal department said, you know, this was legal, because he also said that he did what the president asked and not one photon more. But he never got the opinion in writing. Now, who in Washington, D.C. does not get an opinion in writing?
Yeah.
It's obfuscation at the highest. And then he also said, when he was asked by her about the Fourth Amendment, and he basically said that there are standards that have to do when a person is, you know, the sort of reasonable man test that's applied for in law school, that it's reasonable to infringe on the Fourth Amendment.
But the reasonable...
And then she said, Feinstein said, your standard is not my standard.
Well, the reasonable man test is has to do with civil litigation. You know, would a reasonable person think that this is that, you know, or whatever?
Right, I understand that.
The Fourth Amendment threshold is not reasonableness. The Fourth Amendment test is whether you can convince a judge that a crime has probably been committed and that there therefore is probable cause to issue a search warrant.
That is the standard that they're using.
So
it is I mean, and what he also, I mean, he said several times in different ways about the fact that it's time that the CIA essentially began to increase, and he said the CIA has got to get bigger and do more. And he said the CIA has to have responsibility for human intelligence across the government.
Wow.
It's a scary time we live in, my friend.
Super spy. Yeah, I agree. Ellen, it's well said. Ellen Ratner, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Always good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
This is your one and only. You got to run. Oh, baby, if you want to run.
And welcome back to the place where we dare to ask the questions the mainstream media is afraid of. The Tom Hartman radio program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECOWINE. Little Miss Run Amok, Judith Miller, as Carolyn Kay over at MakeThemAccountable.com lays out. Carolyn does a great job. She just kind of pulls this together. She says, what did George Bush himself know prior to the attacks? Why were certain people warned not to fly on or about September 11 or even earlier and not the rest of us? And did the U.S. know that the attacks were going to happen? I mean, we know, for example, that the head of the Department of Justice was not flying. There's just this whole long catalog of folks who seem to know what was going on. George W. Bush, afraid to go back to Washington, D.C., waiting week after week after week after week after week after week. Here we are about 5-6 weeks down the road since he left Washington, D.C., since they started saying, hey, George, it's going to happen any day, going to happen any day. And George is like, I think I got out. I'm going to get out of town here. I'll be back. Don't you worry. And he just never came back. No, he never came back, and his fate is now known. That's it. Was it, as Carolyn Kay says, was it due to incompetence or was it purposeful? It could only have been one or the other. If it was purposeful, writes Carolyn over at MakeThemAccountable.com, if it was purposeful, the administration was providing itself the new Pearl Harbor that the Project for a New American Century said would be necessary to scare the American people into becoming militaristic and giving up our freedoms. I mean, sometimes Occam's razor is right. The easiest answer to a complex question is the simplest answer. Bush knew, and he didn't do anything to stop it. And, in fact, there is some evidence that they did everything that they could to impede people who were trying to stop it, like Richard Clark, Colleen Rowley, to try and stop them from stopping it. Because there was nothing in the world that Bush needed more than an attack. Now, my personal theory is that Bush knew it was going to happen in New York and Washington. He didn't know where. He knew it would probably involve airplanes, but he didn't know for sure how. Might have been a small plane hijack, might have been intentionally flight. Frankly, I don't think that he knew the level of detail that is out there. And it's just my personal theory. But I could be wrong. I probably am. And I'll put that right out. I don't know. What I do know is that Carolyn is right when she says it's either incompetence or intentional. And in either case, that's an indictable offense in terms of an impeachment indictment, a bill of impeachment against George W. Bush for dropping the ball and allowing 9/11 to happen. And then for the last 5 years, capitalizing it in ways that made his friends rich, made his vice president rich, made his daddy rich, made him rich, and led to the deaths of over 100,000 people, including several thousand Americans. I mean, by the time Bush finishes up his presidency, we will have lost more soldiers in Iraq than we lost civilians in 9/11. But it's worked out very well for him. Anyway, let's get back to your thoughts on all this kind of stuff here. Dean in Everett, Washington. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Hi. I've been listening to your show the past week, and I've got a few little questions, and I want to make a comment that I believe it was called We the People. They had a big tax agenda DVD conference with the IRS scheduled to happen like right after 9/11, and then it was canceled due to 9/11 and postponed, and then after that it was pretty much unpatriotic to go after the income tax system. Another thing I wanted to mention, Jeb signed the Project for a New American Century. Martial law was already in effect in Florida before 9/11.
Right, they declared a state of emergency the day his brother showed up.
Yeah, and then George Bush banned air marshals 2 weeks before 9/11.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and another
banned them?
Banned them. Okay, and another thing I'd like to mention is, I heard you talking about this earlier this week. Is it illegal for the CIA to do operations inside of America, or wasn't that overturned after 9/11?
You know, I, in terms of the super technical legality of it all, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not, and I don't have insight.
Well,
into
that.
I believe this was the case
until the Patriot Act was passed.
The Patriot Act, I don't think gives. I'm pretty sure the word CIA or Central Intelligence Agency is nowhere to be found in the Patriot Act. The big problem with the Patriot Act is it gives the FBI the ability to go to basically, you know, bust into our houses or electronically bust into us without having to get a warrant. They can simply write this national security letter. They can write their own warrant.
Okay. Well, what I was getting at is that Cheney went to the CIA headquarters once every month the year before 9/11 to oversee the simulations of the planes flying into the Pentagon and the Trade Towers, and it's well documented that they were doing simulations that morning.
Yeah, they were doing a simulation of an attack.
Right.
That's
the reason why Cheney was there every month prior to 9/11, starting at 2000.
Interesting.
Because they were practicing for this simulation of 9/11.
See,
he's the only president in history ever did go to the CIA headquarters that many times.
Yeah, vice president. Yeah, well, you know, well said, Dean. And you raise a whole lot of issues that need to be seriously investigated. I mean, none of us should believe anything simply because it's said. These things need to be seriously investigated, and there has not been a serious investigation of this. And the investigation, in my opinion, should not start at, did Tower 1 come down because of explosives or because of an airplane? Either one is possible in my universe. I just don't know. But the investigation should start at who knew inside the Bush administration that 9/11 was going to happen, or who could have prevented it, and why did they not prevent it? And then I would go to the second step of, then why did the Bush administration use 9/11 as a pretext to get us into Iraq rather than responding to it by tracking down Osama bin Laden, if he was actually responsible? I mean, these are just the fundamental core questions. And then, you know, all the millions of questions that go beyond that. Who bought the puts? You know, how did these towers come down? Why was the evidence destroyed? What happened at the Pentagon? What happened in Pennsylvania, in that field in Pennsylvania? You know, there has been no serious investigation of these things. Don in Lodi, California. Hey, Don.
Yes.
What's up? You are on the air.
Okay, I just wanted to chime in on the possibility that President Bush's stock in the Texas Rangers of $600,000 given by Papa was approximately 0.5%. He held on to it for some time when one of his multimillionaire Texans paid a total of $15 million worth of $600,000 worth of stock, which is really money on steroids.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. There's your story.
Suspicious way of laundering money, isn't it?
Yeah, and he was a minority owner, and he goes around talking about himself as, when I owned the Texas, yeah, right, yeah, it is.
Half a percent.
Yeah, thank you, Don. I'm sorry, Don, I dropped you there. I thought you were done. It's John in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, what's up?
Honor to talk to you and your audience.
I
studied this 9/11 more than anybody, and I was in military intelligence, you know, the Vietnam War, and I remember back during the Iran-Contra, I used to tell people about America's secret wars and our terrorism and all our covert operations. They never believed me. And I used to tell these people, I had $50,000 in my retirement account, and if you could prove me wrong, I will give you $50,000. If you can't prove me wrong, all you got to give me is $100. And I would tell them to read three simple books, like John Stockwell's Praetorian Guard, Philip Agee's Inside the Company, and Mike Levine's Deep Cover. But my point is,
of the three, I've read Agee's book.
Who's?
Philip Agee's.
Like he said, they fixed the elections in Chile by pre-programming the voting machines.
It's a pretty solid book, in my opinion.
I went to vote yesterday. Tuesday was pretty horrible to see these voting machines. You have no idea what's inside them things. But my point is, there's a group out there called reopen911.org. That's Jim Walters.
Mm-hmm.
And when I argue with people, I say to them, Jim Walters is offering $1 million to anyone who can convince him that those two airplanes, or those airplanes on 9/11, brought down the two towers. And I argue about World Trade Center number 7. That was two blocks away from the World Trade Centers.
Sure.
So it's a 47-story building, correct?
You're not going to get any argument from me here, John, on this.
But I want to know
why this happened.
Well, because the Security Exchange Commission was inside World Trade Center number 7, but it collapsed 7 hours after the other two towers collapsed.
Right.
There was only two small fires. And then Jim Walters shows a picture on his website. The hole in the Pentagon is only 12 foot in diameter. Okay, and there's no puncture wounds where the two engines would have been.
Right.
And it shows all the equipment laying on the lawn. It was never touched. But no, here's another scenario. Remember when the United States was at war with Iran during the Ayatollah Khomeini, we were having our trouble with them?
Yeah.
Remember the USS Vincennes shot down the Iranian jetliner?
Yes.
Okay, now, I'll never forget this day because I was really into this betting people in America was a terrorist nation, and I love my country. I just want to straighten them out because my motives are really personal. I just think the money could be used better for me instead of on a military-industrial complex. But anyway, I'll never forget this as long as I live. I was watching McNeil Air News Hour that night, and they brought the Iranian ambassador on from the United Nations, and he's up in New York City screaming, the United States did this on purpose. He goes, you know, and it's really hard to argue because, you know, it was a really bad situation where one of our, you thought it was a jetliner. I'm going to tell you what, we have civilian suicide SWAT teams, three-man teams. If you Americans kill one more Iranians or you commit one more act of terrorism against our sovereign nation, we are going to hijack your commercial jetliners and we're going to fly them in your nuclear power plant.
Is this your suggestion, John?
No, this was on McNeil Air's. This was actually an Iranian ambassador warning that they were going to hijack commercial jetliners.
This is what the Iranian ambassador said.
Yeah, this was during Iran. This was before Iran-Contra. This was before Ronald Reagan was the president.
But, John, a lot of information there, and I appreciate it. I have to wrap it up here. We have to take a break, but it's a topic that's not going to go away and should not. We need a whole lot more discussion of this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Looking for a leader to bring our country home. Looking for somebody, done enough to take it on. Clean up the corruption, make the country strong.
And welcome back, my friends. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, the place where being progressive never felt so good. Tom Hartman radio program, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Larry in Seattle. Hey, Larry.
Hey, thank you, Tom. A great day to you from the bright, sunny Pacific Northwest.
Well, thank you. I'm here in Portland, and it's beautiful, too.
Yes, two comments, if I may. One on Rumsfeld and his comment on intelligence, and then the other couple of data points on Bush and what does he know. On Rumsfeld and his inane comments on intelligence, so why was it one of the very first things that he did when he came to office as Secretary of Defense to create a brand new chair, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence, and man it with Stephen Cambone, who has been very instrumental in the into the Inquisition, into these detainees in Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo. He was very instrumental in the Able Danger hearings. If Rumsfeld doesn't have anything to do with intelligence, then what the heck is this Stephen Cambone doing with a job?
Right. No, Rumsfeld was simply lying.
Absolutely.
I mean, he runs the largest intelligence operation in the United States government. The Pentagon's budget is mind-boggling.
85% of the budget goes to him, and who knows how many other dollars from other agencies that are called black budget dollars also are going there that we don't know anything about off the books. Okay, on the Bush and what he know, August 29, 2001, there were two things that occurred, two data points. One came out in an article a year later when Ramzi Bin al-Shib was captured. He gave an interview just prior to that Time magazine and said that on August 29, 2001, he made phone calls from Hamburg, Germany, to all the operational cells, al-Qaeda cells in Europe, that the match was lit for September the 11th. Mm-hmm. I believe this information was intercepted by the German intelligence and was transmitted to the NSA, and they had that information in hand. Also on August 29th, George Bush was coming off of his extended vacation and gave his first speech to a large audience. It was the American Legion, and he gave that on the defense budget. He said very little, if anything, on terrorism, but after the speech, he gave a question and answer period. He went right around the curtain on the dais there, and he went before the CNN camera and various print reporters.
Now, once again, this is before 9/11.
This is on August 29, 2001,
right.
14 days prior to September 11th. He was answering questions about the speech, and one of the print reporters asked him, Mr. Bush or President Bush, could you tell me that the Social Security lockbox is secure? George Bush looked at him, and he said, the Social Security lockbox is secure unless there is a national emergency or a war.
Yeah.
At that time, I looked at my wife and I said, a war. He used the W word. This is the first time that he has mentioned war and anything to do with war, and especially with the Social Security lockbox. He started to walk off of the dais. He took four steps down. I believe Karen Hughes, Dan Bartlett, and a couple of his handlers were with him. They were following him out. He was walking out the door, and the same print reporter asked him, I can be assured to tell my readers that the Social Security lockbox is secure. George Bush turned around. He walked three steps back. He looked right at the guy in the eye, pointed at him. He said, yes. Unless there's a national emergency. He turned to leave, and then suddenly, as if somebody tugged him on the shoulder, he turned around and said, or if there's a war, if there's a war. And with that, Karen Hughes dragged him out the door.
Amazing.
So with those two pieces of information in mind, well, with one, I didn't know the other one because that didn't come out until a year later about Ramzi Bin al-Shib. But with that in mind, when September 11th happened, I watched it with horror, as everybody else did. I watched it transpire on the television. I went from station to station. I recorded a whole bunch of it. The very next day, on September the 12th, I got on the telephone and was talking to a local Seattle talk show and mentioned to the host that I believed that George Bush or his administration knew that this was going to happen and allowed it to happen. There was horror out of the talk show host's mouth, but he said, you are telling me that? And I said, yes, and I'll stand by it. And I stand by that to this day.
Yeah. Well said, Larry, and I appreciate your calling and saying it. In fact, here's George W. Bush a little later on.
You know, I was campaigning in Chicago, and somebody asked me, is there ever any time where the budget might have to go into deficit? I said, only if we were at war or had a national emergency or were in a recession. Little did I realize we'd get the trifecta.
Yeah, war, national emergency, or recession. And it actually wasn't Bush who said that. He never said that. It was Al Gore who said that, oddly enough. The three circumstances. But fascinating point, Larry. Mark in Florence, Oregon. Hey, Mark.
Morning, Tom.
Hey, I think we have about a minute left, maybe a little less, Mark. Real quick point?
Yeah, Tom, I'll have to go cut to the chase here. When you look at Eric Hufschmidt's video, Troubling Questions,
mm-hmm.
you find that there is actually a white plume of smoke that accompanies the explosion.
At the Pentagon?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And that's actually highly indicative of a missile.
Interesting.
When you look inside the hole, you can actually see the wheel of a global hawk. It's very distinctive. It's actually inside there. It's on the video.
Yeah, no, the videos are very convincing, Mark. As I said, I don't know. I don't pretend to be an expert on any of this stuff, and I'm not here to take a position on it, other than that, number one, we need to be investigating it. And number two, the question that Bush does not want us to ask is the one that we must be asking. What did Bush know, and when did he know it, and why didn't he do anything? 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. By the way, for all of those of you out there who earn in the neighborhood of $40,000 a year, I know you'll be relieved to discover that it's now official. You don't pay any taxes. Yep, that's what Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, Dennis Hastert, the number three guy in line for the presidency, just said on the floor of the House of Representatives. By the way, people say, we can't impeach Bush because then we'll have Hastert as president. No, actually, the only way you can impeach Bush is if the Democrats take over the House and the Senate. And if they do, then Nancy Pelosi will be the Speaker of the House, in which case, if you impeached both Bush and Cheney at the same time for high crimes and misdemeanors, then Nancy Pelosi becomes president. That's not a bad outcome in my universe. Anyhow, here's Dennis Hastert.
If you earned $40,000 a year, you know, you wouldn't get a very big tax cut. Well, folks, if you earn $40,000 a year, a family of two children, you don't pay any taxes. So you probably, if you don't pay any taxes, you're not going to get a very big tax cut. Now,
boo, you hear all the Democrats going, wait a minute. Anyhow, we'll get back to that. We'll get back to your calls on this whole 9/11 issue. And what did Bush know and when did he know it? The Competitive Enterprise Institute, they're trying to scramble the information on carbon dioxide. Plus, we're going to have a Taking Our Country Back segment in in about 10 minutes here. We're going to have a candidate on that we'll share with you, Sam Simpson, who's running for office down in Florida in the 10th Congressional District. But right now, John Gideon is with us. He's the executive director for Voters Unite, votersunite.org. And, John, welcome to the program. Excuse me, Vote Trust USA?
Yeah, well, I'm executive director of Voters Unite and information manager for Vote Trust USA, which is an umbrella group that's bringing together all of the smaller voting activist groups across the country.
Great. Okay, John Gideon, welcome to the program. Let's just go through some of the headlines here. I'll toss headlines at you, and you can give us the short story, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
What's going on? Number one, e-voting train wreck 2006. The wheels coming off as Diebold melts down.
Yeah, that's essentially concerning the hole that was discovered by Black Box Voting, Bev Harris and Harry Hursty. She brought Harry Hursty over to Emory County, Utah. They went in and looked at the machines. A real hero, Bruce Funk, who was the elections director in that county, opened the machines up to them because he had concerns. He let them go in and look at it, and they found some immense holes in the security that had been one of them had been discussed before, but not in any great depth or anything else. And now everybody is aware that there are problems, and states should be scrambling to fix the problems or to do actions to mitigate it until such time as Diebold can fix the problem.
Now, these are basically backdoor hack, holes. They were built into them by the Diebold software engineers so that if Diebold needed to update their software on the fly without letting anybody know about it, kind of in secret, without disclosing it to the states because they'd found some error that they didn't want anybody to know about, it might affect their stock price, that they could hack into their own machines and clean up their software and hack back out again, and the elections officials would never even know it had happened. It could even happen during an election. Is that an accurate characterization of my understanding of what I'm reading here?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in most states, just what you described is highly illegal because that software is probably not been previously
certified.
Inspected and certified and everything.
Right. But you can understand why a company would want to do that. They'd want to have control over their own product, and they'd want to be able to make sure that their own product can be improved and updated. I mean, it's just this illustrates the problem with putting our vote in the hands of private for-profit corporations that are more concerned about what happens to the price of their stock than about whether or not our votes are delivered accurately to us.
Yes.
It's just the bottom line. Okay, Pennsylvania state directive on new Diebold security hole identical to Diebold's inadequate notification. This is the same story?
Yeah, it's pretty much the same story, except that Diebold put out a press release to kind of try to cover all of this up a little bit and to gray the waters, so to speak. And exactly what was in this press release and a letter to the state was just copied and pasted over to a letter from the Secretary of the Commonwealth to the counties.
So we now have the Secretary of State passing along Diebold's press release as essentially, here's our response.
Yes.
Yeah, and by the way, this backdoor hole is, you know, before you guys publicized it and Bev Harris publicized it, theoretically, only Diebold and Diebold programmers and former Diebold employees knew that it existed. And perhaps Wally O'Dell, the Republican in Ohio. But now, everybody knows it exists. So Democrats could hack these machines, too.
Well, except that so far the details of these security vulnerabilities are being kept secret because the computer security specialists feel that that's the proper way to go about things is to keep the details away from people so just anybody won't go in and do anything.
So you guys are not revealing the Diebold secrets either, or at least the people who originally discovered them.
That I think is going to change pretty quick. There's more and more dissent against the few computer security specialists who want to keep it secret and by big organizations who are saying, no, we can't do this.
Right.
We've been in activism for a long time, and that's not the way to handle this.
There you go. We're talking to John Gideon, the executive director over, and he works also at Vote Trust USA and the executive director of Voters Unite, votetrustusa.org, the website. In Texas, ESNS, the company that is owned by the company that Chuck Hagel was the president of when he sold his vending machines, or his voting machines, rather, to the state of Nebraska and then got himself elected on them. Chuck Hagel's old company, ESNS, Vendor Bender in Wichita Falls election in Texas?
Yeah, ESNS has, by the way, I've got to put in a pitch. I think all these headlines are all from bradblog.com, and Brad deserves some credit for his work on this.
This one's actually bylined to Joan Krawitz, but yes, Brad is doing a great job out there at bradblog.com.
ESNS is essentially, they went out, they saw an opportunity, as did the other companies, to make millions of dollars off the Help America Vote Act. So they've gone out and they have way oversold their ability to provide products and technological help. And they have caused problems in all of the primaries that they have been involved in so far.
Well, and I can tell you here in Oregon, the Secretary of State is suing them.
Yes. Yep.
I mean,
and Oregon is not the only one. There are hearings going to be taking place in Indiana. West Virginia has already filed a formal complaint with the Election Assistance Commission. I wouldn't doubt that something comes out of Arkansas after they get done with their election because they have had to essentially have been forced to break the Help America Vote Act, the law, in their early voting because they haven't had the voting machines there for the disabled voters.
Right, yeah, which is the problem here, because we have vote by mail, you know.
Right.
Okay, another story, bylined by Joan Krawitz, added again, Diebold ships uncertified machines to Florida. I mean, this is a system that's completely messed up.
Yes. Yeah, in that case, they have their Diebold TSX, their top-of-the-line direct recording electronic voting machine, has apparently four different iterations, and the last iteration is a Type D machine, and one observant poll worker in Volusia County, Florida, noticed that the machine that he was testing, getting ready to be used in the future, or doing their receipt testing on it, he noticed that it was different than the rest of the machines that he had ever looked at. He raised the question, and they found out that these were the Type D machines. They've never been certified by the state. Nobody in the state's ever looked at them. And, of course, the state of Florida, the Secretary of State's office, is covering all this up and saying, oh, that's all right. We knew that this was going to all be happening, and we're going to take care of it, just do a day's worth of testing and buy these things off.
What an incredible mess. John Gideon, VoteTrustUSA.org, the website, and also VotersUnite.org. John, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
It gets worse and worse the more you dig in this thing. We just need to say, we don't want any private corporations between us and our vote. It's just that simple. It is, privatizing the vote is a crime. It's a crime against democracy. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the Chinese. And you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
And welcome back, my friends. Some months ago, we asked Congressman Bernie Sanders, how can we most effectively and appropriately get control of Congress back? You know, should people be sending their money to the DNC or the DLC, God forbid, or the DCCC or whatever? You know, what should they do? And he said, find individual candidates who are out there doing good work and support them. Go to their website, send them $5, $50, whatever you can afford, and give them some publicity. And we've been doing that ever since. Sam Simpson is with us, our Taking Our Country Back segment today. Sam with two M's, S-A-M-M, Simpson, forcongress.com, her website. Sam, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great to have you with us. You're running for Congress in Florida's 10th Congressional District. If my recollection is right, that's Bill Young's territory.
Yes, Mr. Young is a 36-year Republican incumbent. It is considered the race, and personally, I like those odds.
Yeah, it's impossible, and you're going to take it on.
That's right.
Well, good on you, Sam. It's just absolutely great. Now, Bill Wilson, he's got $400,000 in his war chest. He has the power of incumbency. He's been 36 years. The guy's 75 years old. He's got everything wired well for him in terms of connections in Washington, D.C. and like that. And
he says, you know, we're not only talking about protections in Washington, D.C., we're talking about gerrymandered districts all over the country, too. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, there you go. So he says about the war in Iraq, for example. He says, people don't like that, the war in Iraq. He says, I don't like that, but I also know we can't turn the world over to the terrorists because they're killers.
I disagree that by withdrawing from Iraq, we turn the world over to terrorists. I think that that's an incorrect statement. I believe that we have to withdraw from Iraq because we are creating new enemies every day. I mean, anybody that reads or seeks the truth knows that this war is unjust, immoral, based on lies, and the United States has to change course.
What do you see, Sam Simpson? We're talking with Sam Simpson, running for the 10th District in Congress, S-A-M-M, Simpson, 4, F-O-R, Congress.com. And Sam, what do you see as the major issues of our day? What are the things that if you go to Congress representing the 10th District in Florida and people from anywhere in the country, of course, can support you in this, what would be the your top priorities when you get there?
I think the top priority is changing the direction of the country in terms of our economy and our energy policy being based on fossil fuels. I think it's absolutely imperative that we need national leadership to say no more, that we have a national discussion on which way we go and how do we develop our world away from oil and gas. Number two, the withdrawal from Iraq and looking at our foreign policy and seeing what we've done, looking at it as a national program over the last 30 years and what we've done, and we need to bring it back and change and basically repent, if I might be so bold. Rebuild education, for heaven's sake. A Time magazine article says 30% of kids don't even graduate from high school. What has happened? We need to bring back hope and vision for people. We need to restore our economy through creating new jobs, and we can do that if we take our energy policy and we just begin to turn that around. This is not going to be easy, Tom. This is not going to be easy. I mean, we're talking, the United States, I believe, is in trouble. We've got trillions of dollars in debt that we owe. I mean, the Treasury bills, China holds them, Japan holds them, the Middle East, you know, Thailand holds them. You know, we're overextended. Our deficit is terrible. Education is key. Getting out of Iraq is key. Really looking at our foreign policy, taking back the idea, taking back our civil liberties, for heaven's sakes. There are so many issues. How can I boil it down into two or three? Number one, investigate the president, investigate the torture, investigate Cheney, investigate Rumsfeld. We got to get that taken care of, and we need to most likely impeach this president. And number one, number two, withdraw our troops from Iraq and begin to engage in some kind of a diplomacy. And I would say withdraw Halliburton and Bechtel and these other companies from Iraq too, and demand that they give that money back that they wasted to some sort of international consortium that can actually be geared toward rebuilding the schools and the water in that country.
Yeah, or just give it to Iraq.
They
don't know how to build a country. They did it before.
Exactly. I mean, there's a, you know, the employment. There was an Iraqi doctor, a beautiful Code Pink, brought six people over to America, and she was sitting there telling us there's no labor, there's no jobs, there's nothing. There's devastation. They have they have electricity 1 hour a day. And we've done that. We've done that. And we, you know, we break it, we bought it. You know, I think we're going to have to make reparations somehow. But we don't need to be there, and we don't need to be involved in it, and our certain corporations certainly do not need to benefit from that.
Yep, they have their own construction companies. They know how to put up an army. They had one until we arrived.
That's right.
They put it back together in short order.
So
Sam
education,
Simpson,
energy, and getting out of that.
Getting out of Iraq. Sam
right.
Simpson, her website, SAMM, two M's. Sam Simpson, SIMPSON, 4FOR Congress.com. Check it out. Sam, thanks for being with us today.
Bless you, Tom. Thank you.
And good luck.
Okay.
Good luck. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, yeah, man. Just keep rolling along. As Roy in the chat room in New Mexico points out, big win in New Mexico. This is what happens when you just persist. David Cobb and Michael Badnarik sued the state of New Mexico because the state says, you want a recount? Pay up front for the entire cost. It's like $1 million. And so they sued. They said, this isn't right. We're talking about democracy here. We're not talking about how much does it cost to do a recount. What are you going to cost? Are you going to charge me when I go to the vote to go to the poll for my vote? Well, we used to. It was called poll tax, and the function was to keep only rich people able to vote. Now they want to make sure only rich people can recount the vote. Sorry. New Mexico Supreme Court says no, no to Bill Richardson, no to the poll tax. Good on you. Congratulations, Roy. Great to see that happened. 1-866-440-8466. We're still continuing here on our discussion of what did Bush know and when did he know it. Matt in El Dorado, California. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
Well, first of all, you're right about you have to start with basic things like on the labor coming across the border. If you don't hire them, they won't come. And don't go any further.
Yeah.
That is the whole story. There is no other story. Now, in this thing, it's the same deal. Whether he knew exactly when or exactly what he knew doesn't really matter, because when the first plane hit, he was walking into that classroom, right?
Well,
they informed him on the way into the classroom, the first plane.
It depends really on the story that you hear from George W. Bush. I'm trying to find this thing here. I know I've got it. Here's what George W. Bush said about the, well, okay, you continue with your next where you're going.
Okay, well, that's what was said at the time, and if they're trying to change their story now, who cares? Every murderer changes their story. But the whole point is, he knew at the time he was walking in, the first plane had hit, and
here's what George W. Bush had to say. Just I'll get your take on this, Matt.
You're not going to believe what state I was in when I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida. And my chief of staff, Andy Card, well, actually, I was in a classroom talking about a reading program that works. And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower the TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And I said, it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. I was sitting in the classroom, and Andy Card, my chief of staff, was sitting over here, walked in and said, a second plane has hit the tower. America's under attack.
So Bush saying that he actually saw the first plane hit the first tower, although nobody in the United States saw that, nobody in the world saw that for a full 24 hours until that French tourist's video was found. Because nobody had a camera pointed at the towers for the first plane.
Right, exactly. Now here's
very strange.
Point. And so, as a good lawyer, you don't go on to the second point till you prove your first point. You don't leave it hanging. And so, what we can prove scientifically by a fact, is that he knew before he went into the classroom a major disaster had happened.
Yeah.
Major. Many hundreds of lives lost. He knew that. Right?
Sure. Well, according to his own admission.
Story. There's no other thing you have to go to. That's it. Yeah. He knew beforehand. We don't care when or how. He knew beforehand. His reaction was the reaction of a person who had knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And you think
not
seven...
that he didn't care, not that he was confused.
Sure. What do you think was going through his mind during those 7 long minutes where he sat there with that agonizing grin on his face?
I think he said, "We've crossed the Rubicon."
Yeah. We've got that. Well, he, you know,
we've crossed the Rubicon.
You know what he wrote
to a dictatorship.
You know what he wrote in his diary.
I don't care.
The White House releases the president's diary, so he knows he's writing this for the public. In his diary, he wrote, "Today we had a Pearl Harbor event."
Right, but see, that was already a preconceived thing in his mind.
Exactly, because the Project for a New American Century back in 98 that his brother had signed said, you know, we're only going to get our war in Iraq if we have a Pearl Harbor event. I mean,
so does it matter what hit the Pentagon? Does it matter how the trade centers came down? No. The fact is our president was complicit in the murder of hundreds and hundreds of people. If people wanted to say he didn't, fine, they're denying the reality of it.
Yeah, I'm with you there,
well,
Matt.
Well, God bless you, and God bless America.
There you go. Thank you very much. I well said. Alice in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Alice.
Oh, Tom, allowed to happen is not the way it was. The more we study Jim Mars and David Ray Griffin evidence, the more we have to know. It was an inside job. We just learned that Cuba and Venezuela also provided clear warnings that were ignored. Venezuela is setting up their own 911 commission.
Now, that's going to make Bush really happy.
Yeah, I had to wait a long time to get you.
thanks for sitting on hold as long as you did, Alice. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And thank you for your comments. It's always great to hear from you.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye. Jake in Arcata, California. Hey, Jake.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
First off, I want to thank you for giving us a fair shake because we were constantly misrepresented in the media
as you know, a small group of wackos, which is far from the truth.
Which particular us are you talking about, Jake?
I'm just talking about on CNN, Fox News, all that good
but
stuff.
But the us you're talking about is people who believe that there was a conspiracy that led to 9/11, is that what you mean?
Yeah, huh? Okay. Yeah, you know, as far as prior knowledge or as far as controlled demolition or any of that stuff.
Sure.
And,
I think it's all possible. I just don't know.
Yeah, okay. I definitely understand that. But then I just want to bring up a little known fact that was buried by the media and was left out of the omission report, which was Jack Abramoff had his Sun Cruise, you know, unregulated gambling and booze, like cruise line.
Right. This is the cruise line that he bought from the guy down in Florida who was then murdered.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So 2 weeks after the attacks, employees of the cruise line handed over photos, and they're like, look, this guy was a regular on our cruise line, he had been there 6 days before the attack. So it's like...
And it was
like,
Muhammad Atta?
Yeah, they handed over photos, and it just got buried in the media. You know?
Muhammad Atta hanging out with Jack Abramoff?
Yeah, he was a regular on his cruise line. You know, it's like, come on, people, connect the dots here. I just want to urge your listeners to really... investigate this. This is a big issue. It's not some wacko conspiracy theory, and Americans have a right to know.
Yeah.
The information's out there. There's plenty of, you know, informative websites. The information's out there.
Yep. Jeff, thanks a lot, Jake.
Yeah, that's my little known fact for the day.
Yep. Okay.
Right.
Well, it's a good one. It's a good one.
All
I appreciate
right.
it. Yeah, I'd love to see those pictures. If anybody ever gets them, be sure and, you know, drop by our message board or send me an email. Dick, or call the program, actually. Dick in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dick.
Yeah, Tom. You know, one of your earlier guests was saying, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. And you know, you hear that all the time in the establishment media. And what that tells me is it's one of two things. You know, either they don't do any research beyond the media propaganda level, or they're just another stooge, you know, for those who actually are behind our economic and...
Well, let's just consider for a minute, Dick, if what is a conspiracy? I mean, if a half a dozen people get together and decide that they're going to do something that's going to benefit them, and much of what they do, they're going to do in secret, that's, you know, so that other people can't stop them from doing it or prevent them from gaining benefit, that's called a business.
What a conspiracy is that we talk about is a previous detailed planning that goes into activities which generally are considered illegal. You know, and I call people who deny these things, and I call them coincidence theorists because they're always trying to sell us the idea, oh, these things just happened by accident.
Right.
You know, and I don't know what their motives are. Maybe it's profit, peer group conformity, or both. But they don't want you to look behind the curtain, you know.
For a lot of them, Dick, it's just that people don't. They just emotionally at some level can't get their arms around the idea that anybody would be that corrupt or evil, particularly anybody who's running our country.
Dr. Michael Parenti, who's, as you know, a great progressive and speaker, he did a talk on this subject called Conspiracy and Class Power, and I want to highly recommend it if you can find it. As you know, he was a great speaker. He still gives talks, I believe.
Yeah. Well, I'll take a look for it. And, Dick, you know, thanks a lot for the call and for raising that. But, yeah, just because it happened... doesn't, yeah, coincidence theorist. That's great. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to discuss quickly on General Hayden's hearings today.
Yes.
General Carl Levin asked a brilliant question. I don't know if you've already mentioned on your show, but he basically asked him, you know, right after 9/11, the CIA was kind of pressured to come up with intelligence that tied Saddam Hussein to 9/11, mm-hmm. but yet they still concluded that, quote, they were highly dubious that there was any ties between Saddam Hussein and the terrorists.
Right.
And yet Douglas Feiss, who, Tom, remind me, I don't know, I think he was in charge at the time of the Defense Intelligence
Agency. Doug Feiss, the Office of Special Plans. This was the little intelligence agency that operated out of a desk down the hall from Rumsfeld in order to gather information to feed to Cheney to make war rationalizations.
Right, and yet he kind of ignored basically what the CIA's conclusions were, and
right.
he concluded himself that, yes, Saddam Hussein had ties to Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And so he asked, you know, Hayden, he asked him, do you agree with this?
Right, I have the clip of this, Patricia. Here it is, right here. This is just 16 seconds.
Were you comfortable with Mr. Feiss' office approach to intelligence analysis?
No, sir, I wasn't. I wasn't aware of a lot of the activity going on, you know, when it was contemporaneous with running up to the war. No, sir, I wasn't comfortable.
So, you know, is that Hayden trying to whitewash himself, or is that, you know, conflict within the administration? I mean, what's the deal here?
Thank you, Tom.
We just don't know, do we, Patricia?
No, we don't.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's just, yeah, you reach a point where you're going, hey, you know, what? It's another turn. We have to get the Democrats back in control of the House and Senate so some serious questions can get asked and so some decent people can be put in charge of these offices. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air. Long nosed gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Leonard, from your lips to God's ears. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Before I go back to the calls, just real quickly here, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, you've heard various representatives, Sam Salzman, I think, is the guy who's most commonly on, their attorney, as regular guests on this program, CEI.org, their website, they've come out with a whole set of new ads, well, two of them, that say, and you know, they're pretty open about the fact that they get funding from the oil companies, right? They say that the reason why is because the oil companies like what they're doing. And they have come out with some new television ads that say it would be a mistake for us to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant. See, we have laws in this country that allow us to regulate pollutants. We don't have laws that allow us to regulate greenhouse gases because Bush didn't sign the Kyoto Treaty. In fact, he unsigned it. And so the way to get around this that is being pressed forward in Congress is to consider CO2, carbon dioxide, as a pollutant. And you can argue that it is. It's the byproduct of the burning of fossil fuels, among other things. We do exhale carbon dioxide. We inhale oxygen. All animals exhale carbon dioxide. Plants exhale oxygen. It's a nice little cycle, but if you're burning fossil fuels, you're introducing more carbon dioxide into that system, and the consequences are that you don't have a planet anymore. But anyhow, so the Competitive Enterprise Institute trying to tell us it's no problem. You got nothing to worry about.
You've seen those headlines about global warming. The glaciers are melting. We're doomed. That's what several studies supposedly found. But other scientific studies found exactly the opposite.
Now, this is where it gets really interesting. First of all, keep in mind, with regard to Greenland, the edges around the sea are melting, and up at the mountaintops, the snow is actually accumulating faster because the global warming is changing the patterns of snowfall, of moisture. But it is along the surface, along the edges, which is where it's the most dangerous, is where the ice falls into the sea. That is melting. And the Arctic is thinning, but the Antarctic is actually thickening, which is, again, consistent with a disaster scenario associated with global warming, where the northern part of the planet gets warmer and the southern part of the planet, the extreme southern part of the planet, gets colder. So anyhow, the commercial continues.
Greenland's glaciers are growing, not melting. The Antarctic ice sheet is getting thicker, not thinner.
Notice they talk about the Antarctic, but not the Arctic.
Did you see any big headlines about that? Why are they trying to scare us? Global warming alarmists claim the glaciers are melting because of carbon dioxide from the fuels we use. Let's force people to cut back, they say. But we depend on those fuels to grow our food, move our children, light up our lives. And as for carbon dioxide, it isn't smog or smoke. It's what we breathe out and plants breathe in. Carbon dioxide, they call it pollution. We call it life.
Yeah, it's good stuff. We need more of it. Let's burn some more of Exxon's products. Amazing. Paul in Everett, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, listening to the discussion today, it's interesting that the first step is government or the Bush administration sets up a wall of secrecy. The second step is that informed citizens or active citizens start making educated guesses about what's behind the wall of secrecy, and then they are the ones who are denounced as conspiracy theorists.
Right.
You know, basically, so that to be a responsible citizen, the only thing that you can have is this enforced sense of naivete and just kind of putting blinders on all the time.
Yeah, and I would add to that that, in my opinion, and here's, you know, you've heard a couple of my conspiracy theories around this. In my opinion, the Bushies are encouraging people and groups to speculate about the details of 9/11. You know, was it a missile? Was it a plane? Was it a controlled demolition? Was it not? I think that they're encouraging that. I think that they love the fact that we're talking about that stuff, because that means that nobody's talking about what did George Bush know and when did he know it? What did Dick Cheney know and when did he know it? What did Condoleezza Rice know and when did she know it? Why did they allow this to happen? We now have enough information to know that these guys knew that something big was going to happen, and not only did nothing, but apparently actively thwarted government from doing anything. And, you know, why? And that's the question I'm going to ask forever on this program. And I'm telling you, Paul, it's the question they don't want asked by anybody else.
Right. They'll just cherry pick the first theory that's totally wrong, and then use that to try to smear all of the theories.
Yeah.
But one way to get people's heads around this is to look at, you know, when we broke the German code or the Japanese code, the government let people die in bombing raids all the time, because to stop the bombing raids would have revealed that they knew the code.
Yeah.
So they should, you know, everybody should be able to understand the government lets people die all the time. So the question is, did it happen in this case or not?
Yeah, good point. Paul, thanks a lot. BJ in University Place, Washington. We just have a few seconds left. What's up, BJ?
Hey, I just want to, they're going by the playbook set out by NSC 68 back in 1949 or 1948, and they've just replaced communism with terrorism. And it's, once again, they're establishing or building up the military establishment, their covert operations from Venezuela. In Venezuela, Hugo Chavez has gone next, and it's the exact same playbook.
Yep, I don't disagree with you, BJ. You know, well said. And I would say not just Venezuela, Iran as well. But, yeah. Tomorrow, Bernie Sanders is going to be with us. Brunch with Bernie. He'll be taking your calls. And I'll be debating conservative Robert Garmong, who says monopolies and mergers, they're just marvelous things. That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Get out there. Get involved. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.